Welcome back to the program. Amidst all the talk about the importance of education and the endless debate about public policy, we often forget that at the heart of the debate is what it means to be a teacher and the awesome power and responsibility that really comes with that job. Imagine a teacher who does not lecture, but leads, who teaches world peace by studying war, who respects students enough to instill in them the confidence to make the world anew, even as fourth graders. This has been the work of our guest, John Hunter. Teacher and musician, John Hunter is the inventor of the World Peace Game, the star of the documentary World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements, and it is my pleasure and honor to welcome John Hunter here today to talk about his new book, World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. John Hunter, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Jeff. It's just a thrill to be with you, really.
Delight to have you here. Talk a little bit first about how this idea of the World Peace Game got started about the time you became a teacher back in the late 70s.
That's right. You know, the real key thing was my first supervisor when I had my job interview. She said, she answered my question, what should I do with what do you want to do? And that literally shocked me. I was expecting a mandate to be handed a manual to be told what to do and how to teach. And she really opened the door to creativity from within rather than from without. And so with that, being thrown into that empty space of not knowing, I had to fall back on my mentors. One of my mentors, Ethel J. Banks, as an undergraduate in Richmond, Virginia, she said, always use the LOLR. LOLR, what's that? I said. She said, line of least resistance. Find out what your students love, what they care about, who they really are in their deepest heart, and then build curriculum to and around that. So in 1978, my ninth grade students at my first job loved board games. So I figured I'd better use that strength. And I had to teach social studies in Africa. That was my given. And I think problem solving had just been discovered as a great teaching tool around that time. So I mixed in problem solving, the hard limit of what we had to study, and their passion of board games. And that was the first World Peace Game. I didn't know what I was doing, but I'd followed my mentor's advice and really went after who they were first. And that was how we started.
Can you imagine becoming a teacher today with the constraints that exist today, with teaching to the test, no child left behind? It's hard to imagine you doing what you did in the late 70s if you were starting out as a teacher today.
Yeah, it is a very difficult thing to imagine these days. I really feel for new teachers, young teachers coming into the profession with those kind of constraints. And I meet, in traveling now with the book and the film, so many fantastic teachers, so many wonderful up-and-coming graduate students are going to be teachers, idealistic, ready to go, ready to give everything they have, and they're facing that daunting kind of task. And the only thing I can say is, you know, in my career, I've seen policies come and go, and I say that in policies like weather. You know, sometimes it's stormy outside and you put on your heavy coat, and other times the sun is shining and the flowers bloom. So if you can maintain your health and maintain the fundamental relationship between teacher and student, doing the best you can, then perhaps you can weather those changeable, impermanent storms that come and take the best out of the best you can find and hopefully duck and cover from the rest that doesn't suit children's best interests.
Talk a little bit about what the game was like when you first started it, essentially on a 4x5 plywood board.
That's right. I was reaching, I tell you. I went to hobby stores and toy stores getting these little pieces, and I was just making it up as I went along. And the one thing I knew is I had to make it current. So I researched the current news, read the newspaper, and pulled crisis situations, disguised them, made them appropriate for kids, and put them in the game. We were working with real countries on the continent of Africa to start with. And that went rather well for a while, but after a while, after a few years of trying this, I noticed kids began to slow down in their creativity and their critical thinking. I wondered why. And I realized they had been also using real-world country solutions that the parents had offered or that the news and current adult administrators were using, and they were failing like we were. They weren't getting anywhere. So I fictionalized the countries. I gave them the power to make up their own country names. And we had some poor countries, some wealthy countries, countries with different kinds of assets. And we still kept the same universal crisis scenario templates and put those in the game. But they were really liberated to be much more creative because they weren't bound by the history and the conventional thinking that went with our current situations. And so that really started to take off in a much different way, and the evolution of the game really speeded up. So it went from the sort of pedestrian, conventional kind of thinking to a really out-of-the-box creative problem-solving way that really led to a lot of attention and a lot of adults considering it real work. which we're very proud of.
I want to talk about how it evolved during this period of time, because if nothing else, the world was a very different place back in 1978.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So I would try to keep up with the current events and news and make tweaks and modifications to the game. But, you know, the children really are the engine that drives that evolution of that process. If you listen to them and allow their interests, their understandings, their wisdom to guide the curriculum development, you'll have much richer and deeper curriculum, I'm finding. And so they really were pushing the envelope on making it better and bringing in new things. And we all would discuss whether or not it's a good idea. And I wouldn't decide alone. We'd decide together what was a good idea and what was a good process to put in or not. And I remember the actual final, the current stage of the game being a 4 foot by 4 foot by 4 foot plexiglass tower with four by four horizontal sheets of plexiglass, quarter inch thick sheets, stacked one above the other. That evolution came all in a burst. One night I simply just woke up about 2 a.m. and there it was in front of me, the fully grown, fully blown, design, and I just woke up and started scribbling as fast as I could because everything went to warp speed, and the crises also emerged around the structure, and a formula came, and algorithms, and I was just scrambling to get it all down. But sometimes teachers get that. You just get a burst of inspiration, and if you couple it with student evolution and student-driven concerns and interests, I think you're going to have a dynamic product.
When did you bring Sun Tzu into the idea of the game?
Well, actually, you know, I'm not that smart. I didn't. One of my 9-year-old little boys came in with the little pocketbook version of The Art of War one day. And they said, "Mr. Hunter, this Chinese general, he's like 2,500 years old. He wrote this book a long time ago. My mother reads it every night. She's a businesswoman, and her business, she says it helps her. I thought it might help us in the game, you know, because I'm one of the arms dealers. I run a business." So we looked at it. I looked at it, and I offered it to the students. We discussed it, looked it over, and we voted it into the game. We decided, yeah, we're going to use this. So at the beginning of every session, we share a bit of that text with the students. And, you know, the nice thing is they interpret it their own way. You know, I don't try and give it as a prescription, but they look at it, and in their fourth grade understanding, they make of it what they will. And it's beautiful to see Sun Tzu's ideas merge with their own current understanding about the ideal going into the situations.
And as the game has emerged, there's about 1,000 game pieces, as I understand it. The kids make up their own countries, and you include this 13-page crisis document with it.
That's right. That's right. You know, you walk a fine line as a teacher trying to create curriculum. You want to stretch the students. You want them to think out of the box. You want them to grow those great mental muscles and creative muscles. So you really want to push the curriculum to be as best as it can. And yet, at the same time, you don't want to cripple them. You don't want to discourage them completely. You don't want to stop their creative thinking and have them feel they can't do it. So you walk that fine line between the two extremes where it's so hard that they almost can't do it, but so thrilling, as we say, that they have to do it. They buy the fiction. They believe in it so much they really want to. And if it's mixed with their own concerns, their own ideals, their own passions, then you really got a dynamic piece of curriculum going. So those thousands of pieces that make their own countries, and they go off on their own way, creating what they will from it. And I really have to give up some control. I cede control to them as they start to move into the creative aspects of it. And I have to stay on the sidelines and watch. I can't interfere with their game. They make of it what they will. I can ask questions and guide and hopefully offer some advice occasionally. But I've often been found that my ideas are incorrect, and theirs are much more accurate or much more sweeping than mine could ever be.
And many of the problems that they have to solve involve things like nuclear proliferation, water rights, famine, endangered species. Talk a little bit about how they go about the process of problem solving.
That's right, Jeff. The problems, I've tried to have a full spectrum of human misery, basically, and to give them a real challenge. We've got everything from ethnic and religious and minority rights, refugee problems, chemical, nuclear, hazardous waste spills in waterways, fishing rights and overfishing, water rights problems, aquifers, desertification, breakaway republics, you name it, we've got it, famine, endangered species. So I really try and interweave these things to make all the crises interdependent, as I think they really are in the world. And I don't have to preach that or teach that. The students come to find that out experientially themselves by living through it. So we've got these 13 pages of interdependent crises. It takes about 3 hours to go over them. And the students really, the left brain, the analytical side, after 3 hours of going through this, the detailed complexity, it shuts down. You know, their brain cannot do it. And I believe that having that kind of complexity is actually good, rather than breaking things down into bite-sized, pre-chewed pieces for students, thinking their poor little minds can't wrap around large ideas. We actually step up the game and bring in a maximum amount of complexity and challenge them to take it on, and they do willingly and happily. So that crisis scenario is key for them to try and look through everything there and do it all together, and they try and do it without combat if possible.
In the 30 years you've been doing this, many of the problems, sadly enough, that the world faces are very much the same. Talk a little bit about how the solutions have changed and evolved for kids over 30 years.
Well, that's a great question, Jeff, because back when I started in the late 70s, early 80s, there was, I guess the children at that time had a much freer attitude about military engagement. There was the tail end of the Cold War. Things were stepping down from that nuclear escalation we'd had between the U.S. and Russia. And they were sometimes cavalier about the use of weaponry. And so I had to fine-tune that part to bring in deeper considerations and consideration of consequences for that kind of thing. But over time, and particularly after, I'd say, 9/11 here in this country, there's a much deeper consideration among all the children I teach to consider the consequences of these kind of very strong and severe actions. And they're much more hesitant to rush to war. They're much more interested in consensus and in working things out. Although they are allowed to go through that process of war, and they do sometimes choose to do it, and they come through the other side, I think, with a much deeper understanding of what it's really about in a safe and bloodless way. But I can never really design curriculum that would teach them as deeply as they seem to be able to teach themselves by living through things. Things that most teachers might say, please don't do. We don't want you to even think about that. They go through it in a safe, facilitated environment and can understand more deeply than I think I can about what the process really means.
Talk about how these fourth graders get into the idea of strategic thinking.
Well, you know, the game has many stages, and initially the intended complexity makes failure inevitable. The game is designed to fail massively, and it does at first. I know this is coming. I designed it in, and I designed it in because I realize we've been sheltering children from the idea of failure, or basically trying until we achieve the success we want. We have some sort of moral stigma attached to not being correct and right every time the first time. And so I wanted to just make that reflective of life. Life has that built in when things don't always work. So how do we learn to deal with things if we don't actually practice in that environment? So the game is designed to fail massively, and it does, and there's despair at first because even the brightest child cannot figure it out, cannot solve the problem. And so the only thing that gets us through that dark valley is this relationship, and that's key to everything that I do as a teacher. Everything is based on our relationships together, teacher to student, student to student. We built up that community so we can trust each other and support each other through that dark period. Then they go to a stage where they begin to experimentally get a few problems solved, and that success drives them on, and they start to invent or discover collaboration. I don't have to teach it. They realize, I need you to help me do this. I can't do this alone. And so they develop this hyper-collaboration after a while, and they start to solve problems more rapidly. And I get so excited with them because they reach a point in the game where they suddenly understand, we can do this, but it's a we, not a me or an I. And they see themselves as one playing against the game rather than, as I posit in the beginning, playing against each other. And at that point, mastery begins. They become masters and start to really understand and dominate this process, and they're so thrilled with it they don't want to stop playing because they realize they can solve any problem in the world that appears to them, so much so that even the Pentagon is taking notice and they've been invited there to talk about that there. But you know, just that kind of confidence you want to have in children that the possibility exists that you will succeed is such a great great side effect or a great benefit of being able to teach this way.
Talk about the trip to the Pentagon. Former Secretary, Defense Secretary Panetta invited you there last year.
Yes, he did. That was a remarkable experience. You know, Chris Farina, the filmmaker for World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements, and I, back in 2011, were showing the film. We've been invited to Silicon Valley to show it at a design firm there, IDEO. And at the end of the film, this very well-appointed, well-dressed young woman, I mean, very well put together, came up and she handed me a card and it said, "Mr. Hunter," she said, "we'd like to see you." I looked at the card and it said, "Defense Department, Pentagon." And I realized I'd better make some time in my schedule for that appointment. So Chris and I were indeed invited to the Pentagon. We went through the security, got inside, and we found out the film had been screened at the Pentagon for various audiences there inside 4 times, his film, about strategy and children dealing with world problems. They screened it again for us in the company of another audience, and then we had the most moving, poignant discussion with these military policy people and military personnel in a very emotional way. You know, it really opened our eyes. We had this sort of view of the monolithic institution, but these were people with hearts who really had been through so much of 10 years of war, they said to us. It was just so difficult. So they invited our children back after that meeting to actually talk to them about how they achieved these solutions in the game. This is very serious. They weren't doing it for a photo opportunity. They really wanted to try and understand, seeking answers everywhere for these kinds of problems that they face. So my kids dressed up, they studied real-world countries, went in with policy questions, had a press conference with George Little, the press secretary of the Pentagon, stumped him a couple of times, I'm proud to say, and suddenly were ushered into Defense Secretary Leon Panetta's office. What an amazing experience. He said, "I got 10 minutes. He took off his coat and he stayed almost a half an hour talking to the children about policy. He talked about insurgencies in the field and how climate change affects your supply chain in military operations. And the children went with him toe-to-toe, peer-to-peer, because they had lived through what he was talking about and they understood it. And so we met 2, 3, and 4-star generals all day, and even General Martin Dempsey, the head of the Joint Chiefs, gave us a military honor, as well as Panetta, a special coin commemorating the children's efforts and their adventure in peacemaking. It was such a thrilling thing. I don't think they'll ever forget it. I know I won't."
What have you seen over the years in the way in which the kids' individual backgrounds, their socioeconomic backgrounds, their parents, the way in which that initially shapes their approach to the game?
Well, you know, we've got the spectrum of children. I teach in a public school, 560 kids, I guess 23 different ethnic groups and languages. And even the 65% free and reduced lunch, I believe, you know, kids from some kids from poverty. So we've got the spectrum. We've got everybody in this public school in Albemarle County, Virginia. So they bring all kinds of approaches to the game. And what I've consistently found, no matter where they come from, no matter what ethnic group or what language they bring to the room, they have a default. And it's wondrous to see. Their default is, "Let's take care of everybody." I'm shocked and honored every time I see it. They say, "Let's take care of everybody." And the game situation makes it almost impossible to do that. It tempts them to be egocentric. It tempts them to be solo, to go solo in situations. But they overcome those traps that I've laid for them. And they continually, in every game setting, always come to this, "Let's express compassion." They might not say it that way, but they make sure everyone, every tribe, every country, as an increased asset value and all problems are solved in order to win this game. And I'm just warmed by that. You know, I'm so optimistic because no matter where they come from, they all want to do this. And I'm so heartened by that kind of experience to see them like that.
You've been doing this long enough now that you could do your own informal, at least, longitudinal study. Talk about the kids that went through this 15, 20, 25 years ago and what you've seen and how it has shaped their lives, their thinking, and what they've done in the world.
Oh, yeah, that's wonderful. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about those kids. You know, when you're a teacher, you have them for a really short time, actually. You hope you've done a good job, and they leave your classroom, they leave your grade, and you may never see them again. You know, it's a very bittersweet experience to have them go in the world, and you hope to find out what they're doing and how they're doing later on, and sometimes they do come back. So lately, through social media, I would have to say quite a bit these days, students have come back, and they've let me know how they're doing and what effects this game has had on their lives. One in particular, Irene Newman, a student who played the game about 15, 20 years ago. At that time, Irene, a 9-year-old, was getting into trouble. She decided to become a black market arms dealer in the game. You can do that in the game. You can be whatever you want if you can afford it and deal with the consequences. She defied the UN. She went undercover and had a lot of backroom dealings going on I was not happy as a teacher. I don't want to teach that. I'm trying to teach compassion and caring and peacemaking, but the game I designed allows them to find their own way, so I had to wait and see. Her parents were even concerned about her. But she wrote me a beautiful letter. I think it was just last year in 2012, saying, "Mr. Hunter, I saw your TED Talk and I started crying. But I remember I played the game and you let me do all those things that were kind of out of the box. And today it's made me the success I am." She says, "I'm in a university setting, University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. And I'm in War and Peace Studies and International Diplomacy and Security Issues. And you know, Ms. Hunter, I get a tingling in my fingers every time we deal with an international problem and diplomacy. I get so excited, and I'm so good at solving these problems. My professors are just a wonder at how I can do it." And I say to them, "Well, I've been doing diplomacy since I was 9 years old. You know, it's not that difficult at this point." So that's kind of heartwarming. But I think one of the greatest things was I went and gave a talk about the game to a university in Richmond, Virginia, Virginia Commonwealth University. And this old man in the back raised his hand at the end of the talk and stood up, and he had gray at his temples. He was a little bit stooped. He said, "Mr. Hunter, do you remember me?" I said, "No, I don't think so." And he looked familiar, but, "Oh, I played your first World Peace game, and it came back to me some 30-some years ago. He was one of the first players." And he said, "Mr. Hunter, I want to tell you something." In the middle of this gathering, "You did this gesture with your hand. It's kind of an offhand comment you made about something in the game. It's kind of funny." He said, "You didn't really mean anything by it, but it meant a lot to me. It meant so much to me that it really made me, that comment and that gesture, led me to go into educational policy administration in Washington, D.C. It was such a profound thing." And then and later on, we were Skyping, had video chat together. He introduced me to a beautiful young woman. She walked into the room and said, "This is my daughter, and she's going into banking, and I've taught her that gesture, that offhand comment that you said that day," which, of course, I didn't remember. And then he had had a little boy, about 2 years old maybe, walk in, and he said, "This is my grandson, and I'm teaching him that gesture." And it struck me, you know, that as a teacher, you're not teaching just the child in front of you. You may be teaching generations ahead in this single child. So you may be reaching through time. It's an awesome, awesome, awe-filled opportunity and responsibility. So it really sobers you, and you really have to respect that responsibility. And, of course, you've got to engage in self-reflection, so you want to be the best teacher you can be. Remove your prejudices and biases and baggage so you can get out of the way of their real learning. And they can say things like that 10, 20, 30 years later, and your effect may last for even quite a bit longer if you're fortunate.
How did your own background, John, prepare you for this?
Oh, well, that's great. You know, I had loving parents. My mom and dad were very quiet people. At the time, we were living under segregation in Richmond, Virginia, in the South. And we got along very well, but, you know, our way in the family was what I would call the shadow school. There were people in our community who were in the spotlight school, I called it, who'd step out and take public stand on issues that were against integration or against people being who they were, people of color. And my parents were very, very quiet, so our shadow school way was to work quietly behind the scenes. So I learned this kind of behind-the-scenes quiet effort over a long period of time, much like I think Sun Tzu would admire. He would admire my parents, I think, in some ways. But that segregated situation, which had its own inner strengths, actually, was opened up in the late 60s, and I went to an integrated school. I was one of the first students in my school chosen to go. And it turned out to be a wonderful experience, actually, a very opening experience. And it just simply opened the door to the world for me to go even further, remembering the debt and the dedication and the obligation I had to people who weren't able to do that at the time. So that sort of set me up for having this obligation back to my mentors, to my elders, to my legacy, I mean, to my lineage. And it set me up for looking forward to also going out into the world with this hopefully quiet approach to working, you know, dedicatedly over time to achieve a good end for everyone. And I have to give my parents that great credit and my teachers. I'm standing on their shoulders, I say, shoulders of giants, because they made me and everything I do possible.
Is this something that can be scaled, that can be done in other schools and other places?
Well, Jeff, there are people doing it, with and without my blessing. What's happened is people have seen the TED Talk and have tried to tease out how they think the game works and gone ahead and built their own. And they write me and say, you know, is this correct the way we've done it? And I look at it, and of course it's not. And I say, no, but that's wonderful. I applaud your creativity. Please go on with it. Carry on, see where you end up. But there are a few schools, I think, in Milwaukee and Hawaii and of course, in Norway internationally, we've had quite an interest in the game, who have built their own game boards and are actually trying to implement the DNA that I have with this, the formulas that I use. They're just starting this year, so we hope that this will be able to be shared. I would like to leave this legacy. It's not about me. It's really not even about the game. It's about the process and the relationships of critical and creative thinking that's gathered through the relationships, and for students to build tools for problems that we haven't even imagined yet. We have to prepare them for a future that we teachers may not ever live to see. And how do we do that? We have to have them really learn to think and not just memorize. So, yeah, we hope that the scaling is there. There are some independent companies, even a defense contractor contacted us about doing some virtual ideas. But the core of the game has to be maintained, and that's the relationships, the person-to-person, in-the-room kind of feeling. So I don't know if we can do that on our smartphones and with strangers, but we're looking into the possibility.
Beyond the ability to think and to collaborate, which you've talked about, there's also the degree to which the game fosters empathy and compassion. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, Jeff, it's a beautiful thing. Every teacher would like to, of course, have their students come to that. But I've found through this game process, the structure, the game structure is really the teacher. And through that, the students discover, they uncover, they reveal to themselves that the basic good thing in life, the good thing in being human, is to be compassionate, to not think of oneself as alone and separate, but to actually be inclusive. Now, I could attempt to teach that and preach that, and it might be heard, it might not. But they're learning it experientially in this process. I did make the game contingent, its success contingent upon everyone improving their own asset value and all problems being solved. But the way the children interpret it is up to them, how they make that happen. And it's often not the way I would have done it. And often it's better than I would have done it. So this idea of compassion is something I'm glad they come to. I hope they come to. But they discover it themselves, and therefore they own the learning. It's not something passed on to them or forced upon them or that they have to memorize. It's something that they get in their gut, I think. They live through it viscerally. The understanding of how it's great to help others and to be considered and connected with others. So I'm so happy that that happens every time we do the game.
John Hunter, the book is World Peace and Other Fourth Grade Achievements. John, it's been a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Oh, Jeff, thank you so much. Thank you all. Really.
Appreciate it.